He wrote.
Well, okay, I'll go ahead and say what I was going to say. I accidentally overheard a conversation on weather control satellites, and I'm no engineer by a long shot, and I have any knowledge of any of that. And then I just fell into question-asking mode, though, and a dear old retired rear admiral friend of mine verified, and all are kept in the in the dark about a lot of things.
It's constant.
And evidently,
it's
by
constant.
Adding chemicals to both air and water, a lot of weather control can and does go on.
Mm.
And we just don't know about it. I've also been told if there are any whistleblowers and anything regarding weather control satellites that, and I said, well, they'll be fired if they open up? And they laughed at me and said, no, they'll be gotten rid of, literally.
Absolutely.
And
that's
I really
the sickening part about what this administration is doing.
I guess I'm reaching a point where nothing much would surprise me.
Me too. Yeah.
Well, let's hope this doesn't keep happening.
That's
happens.
Kind of intrusive, yeah.
It's a new system, and it's really good. And I think our speech is crystal clear, even no matter how many people get on the call. So it's, but we don't really know the system real well yet.
Well, you know, of course we're being recorded by not just you folks. Of course
That's
we
right.
are.
That's right.
And my motto has come to be, well, I hope I bore them to death.
Should we spell our names?
Recording everything
right.
I do, everything I say.
Oh, God.
Well, I'm awfully glad that it sounds like Zach LaPorte is quite an advocate for all of the vets. And the poor vets certainly need strong advocacy.
Mm.
Is anybody able to speak about, I don't know if the class action has gone forward or not. I heard that there was a class action back in the East, in Federal District Court.
A class action?
Has anybody
action?
Heard anything regarding that?
No.
I have.
So many vets have gone, including my own brother, who's 100% disabled vet, but so many vets have gone without any treatment whatsoever. I've even been asked for help by some doctors and medical people in the VA have begged for help.
Yeah.
One doc said, this isn't practicing medicine. They so often say, we know what they need, but our hands are tied. We can't do it.
That's
surgery,
the most important part of military spending is to take care of those veterans when they get home. You know, that has to be
and
a priority.
I don't know. I would love to have more information on.
Well,
it could have been brought and settled immediately, you know, to keep the word from spreading far and wide that a lot of people are formally complaining. So many of the complaints I've heard have to do with them putting in for disability. And they have to wait forever.
Yeah.
And then far too often they don't get it.
I think a really tragic thing that should be addressed, as I've been following it for a couple of years, is a lot of the returning vets from what they're calling the new wars are coming back so damaged, and they've found that what was taking the Vietnam veterans about 10 years to end up being really down and out, homeless, and in the prison system, these guys are just kind of going direct into the correctional facilities, and then that is not a question that they are asked. It's not a marker that's used inside Department of Corrections whether or not a person has been in combat. So they are not being represented or recognized for their duty and service, and the fact that they become lawbreakers is that I think they're so fractured, but once they get into the system, the VA is very all too pleased because they are absolved of any further responsibility as far as benefits or even to the families, and they are just forgotten, and they just have a really hard time getting back out of the system.
Oh.
And
well,
it's really, really...
That is totally egregious.
It is horrible.
But
I'm going to interrupt
here real quick. I think Zach is on the line. Are you there, Zach?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Hi, Zach.
Yeah.
Hi.
All right. We're at about 12. I don't know what's going on there. That might happen throughout the call. We'll just have to bear with it. Anyway, my name is Robert Hansen. I'm on the IoT kitchen cabinet along with Sally and Virginia and Sandy and Mark. And we're very lucky tonight to have someone that I've known for a little while here in Milwaukee that is very active at showing up at various events, either advocating for veterans or advocating for ending our wars. So I'd like to welcome Zach onto the call here, and I'll let him tell his story to you. I think Jeannie, do we still do *6 on this?
Yes.
To mute.
Yes. Okay.
So while Zach is talking, I'll encourage everyone to just do *6, and that'll mute your phones, and we'll turn it over to Zach here. Thank you.
All right. I'll wait till the beeping stops. Okay, well, I'll just start off. My name is Zach Laporte. I'm a Iraq War veteran. I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, a suburb of Milwaukee. And I guess I'm going to talk a little bit about myself and some of my experiences and kind of how I came to the views that I have on the world and some of the things I'm trying to do to help change it. So I was born in 1983. I was born on a military base in South Dakota. My dad was in the Air Force. My parents got married after I'd been born. I was born into a military family. My Aunt Beth was in the Air Force. My Uncle Tim was an Army Ranger. They both served extensively in the military. I was brought up around a lot of military-type propaganda. And I was really raised to believe that, being in the military, being a member of the military, was honorable. It was a duty. And I tried as hard as I could to really embody that type of honor and that duty. My parents divorced at an early age. And part of my upbringing was, trying to fill the void that was left over from my dad. And so naturally, I looked up to my Uncle Tim. I really saw him as kind of like this hero, like monolithic father figure in my life that I didn't really have. And it kind of set the course for me for the future. My grandma had a lot of, all the Civil War stuff up in the house. And I always looked at that and I thought, well, someday I'm going to do that. Someday I'm going to be that man. So when 9/11 happened, I didn't really have a worldview. I didn't really understand. I saw things in the news that always said, oh, this is terrorism. All I knew about terrorism when I was that age was Timothy McVeigh. So I was 17, actually. I was a senior in high school when 9/11 happened. And I really took on that mentality, thinking, we got to go over there and we got to get those fuckers that killed all these people on 9/11. So I graduated from high school, and my first thought was I was going to go to college. I was going to join up. I was going to be an ROTC. So I went to school for a year, and at the very end of the year, we went to war or invaded Iraq. I watched the bombs fall over Baghdad from my dorm room, and I knew it was going to take me 3 more years before I could graduate from college, at least. and help, you know, help fight for freedom, help defend our constitution, our morals, our values, and everything. And I couldn't live with it. I couldn't live with myself. And so I watched Cheney on TV. I watched Rumsfeld. I watched Colin Powell. I watched all of them. I watched them all talk about what was going on. And I totally bought it. I swallowed the pill. So I went home from school that year, and I decided that I was going to enlist. So I came down to Milwaukee. It was the closest recruiting station that was in the state of Wisconsin. I grew up about 5 hours north of here, so it was quite a drive. Came down, I took all the standardized tests, all the physicals and everything, and they said, well, you scored well enough, you can do pretty much whatever you want. You can do anything. And I decided that I wanted to be just like my uncle. I wanted to be in the airborne infantry. And so I told them that, and I was able to secure a contract, a three years I had to do. And it was really emotional for me. I almost broke down crying sitting in the office. You know, I called my mom right after I signed on the dotted line. I talked to my mom for a couple minutes. She said, "Is this what you want to do?" I said, "Mom, I've never been more sure about anything in my life." So I went home that week, and I started preparing mentally for what I was going to be doing in basic training. But nothing really, I don't think anything actually prepares you. So I left for basic training in January 2004, and I went down to Fort Benning, Georgia, went through 16 weeks of basic training and also infantry school, where I learned how to fight, I learned how to kill people, I learned how to do all that stuff. Immediately when I graduated, I went to airborne school. I learned how to jump out of planes for about 4 weeks. And then I was offered the opportunity, I volunteered to join one of the most elite fighting units in the world. It was the Army Rangers. They're in special operations. They do a lot of missions that, you know, growing up you think, well, this looks really cool. You know, I think I'll do that. And my uncle did it, so I had to prove myself. So I volunteered. And so I started training, and it was really just a selection course. They took us out in the woods. They kept us up all night. You know, they physically abused us. They mentally abused us. They made us run through the woods at 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, it was really like I was never a Boy Scout, but it was really like being a Boy Scout but on steroids. You know, we did all kinds of rifle training, hand-to-hand combat. We dug foxholes. We walked through the woods for hours. We walked along the roads for I think we did 25 miles. So I graduated from that. And I was allowed to choose my duty position. So I picked Joint Lewis Base Lewis McChord up in Washington State. That's exactly where I wanted to be. So I went up there and I started training, and I had absolutely no clue what it was going to be like. So we started training. I was assigned to a machine gun squad. My job was to carry around extra barrels and extra ammunition for this machine gun. It was a large gun, probably weighed about 40 pounds. Fully loaded, it weighed probably 50 or 60 pounds. So I carried all this weight around in the woods, and you know, we jumped out of helicopters, we rappelled out of helicopters, we jumped out of airplanes, onto bases, and all that kind of stuff. And so... In the summer of 2005, I made my first deployment over to Iraq. I went to Baghdad in the Green Zone. We were right off the main route there, Route Irish, which is right in the heart of Baghdad. And it goes from Baghdad International Airport, and it goes straight into the Green Zone. And it had a reputation for being one of the most dangerous 1 mile stretches of freeway in the entire world. And every single day, we would take that road out to go out on missions. And what our missions were like is we would get up in our trucks at about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. It was dark out, and we would do what we called snatch and grab type missions. So we'd load up, we'd figure out what house we were going to. Usually we used a cell phone signal. We were able to lock down the cell phone signals of certain people who had been in contact with people that were known to be bad, people that had been in contact with other people that were known to be bad. So we'd go out, we'd put a shape charge on the door, we'd blow down their doors. Sometimes they knew we were coming, sometimes they didn't. Most of the time the people we were looking for weren't there. We'd blow down their doors, we'd go inside and we'd only find, crying children, women, sleeping in the middle of the floor. My first deployment really, was for me, it was kind of like an eye opener. I didn't really understand what foreign policy was all about until I actually got boots on the ground in Baghdad and most of the surrounding area. I guarded detainees. I saw detainee abuse. I saw multiple times, because we worked with the CIA and also with the so-called Delta Force, if you will, Navy SEALs, Iraqi Special Forces, and some of the things that I just saw done were things that I didn't even know that we actually did things like that. And a lot of times, the things that we did, it was done because we thought there was a possibility that they had the information that we were looking for. It wasn't always, the information. They didn't always have the information we were looking for, and sometimes we just let them go. So I came home a little jaded. I came home at the end of the summer. It was like September, October. And, I knew a lot of guys getting drunk all the time, the epitome of veteran problems is what I saw. You guys getting drunk, getting in fights. I knew a guy that got kicked out of a bar. He got his face caved in into the window of a car. He had scars on his face after that. I knew guys that committed suicide. It was not pretty, and it totally changed my view of the military as being people of honor and people of integrity. We did a lot of dangerous training. I saw a few of my friends. One of my good friends that I went through training was killed in a live fire training exercise because somebody moved a target on a range and never fessed up to it, and there was a huge investigation, but nobody ever found out about it. Nobody ever found out who did it. Everybody knew who pulled the trigger, and that guy unfortunately has to live with that for the rest of his life. He knows that he pulled the trigger. So moving on, so that year I went to Ranger School. I went and I did a lot of training down in Georgia. I came back, and I went to Balad the next year. Balad is a base in Iraq. I went to Iraq, and the last deployment was my eyes opening. This one was like, I can't even explain it. It was like living it. I had to live through it. We went on a lot of missions where we blew up people's houses while we sat outside and watched. We shot a lot of civilians, a lot of people that didn't deserve it. We raided houses that we thought that there were going to be people in there that were bad, and we ended up killing people that were in there, and nobody in there was bad. A lot of these things really changed me. I mean, if before my eyes had been open, at this time, I was shocked. I was radicalized. I was in awe. And about halfway through my deployment, I told my platoon sergeant. I said, I really want to reenlist. I want to come back, and I want to finish the job. I want to go to Afghanistan. And the second half of the deployment was when I really started to realize that this whole thing was fucked. And I decided that I wasn't going to reenlist. So after that deployment, I came home, and I was disturbed. I was misguided. You know, I racked up a bunch of debt that I'm actually still paying off to this day. I'm trying to find myself. I tried becoming a Blackwater contractor. I was actually offered a position with Blackwater for $13,000 a month, tax-free. The only thing I was able to know, however, before I signed the contract is that I would be getting paid $13,000 a month, tax-free, and I would have to go to somewhere in Iraq. That's all I knew. And I finally had an emotional breakdown. I decided not to do it, and for about a year, I just kind of wandered. I drank. I went to community college, but I just had no idea who I was. When I moved back to Wisconsin, it was 2008, and President Obama, or then Senator Obama, was up for election. And I was asked by a couple people to participate with Veterans for Obama and to speak out against what I thought was, quote-unquote, Bush's wars. I saw the war in Iraq as a mistake, and most importantly, I saw it as a partisan one. And I strongly believe that if I could sway voters, you know, by participating in this Veterans for Obama thing, you know, I could probably help end the war. So I went and I spilled my guts. I went and I told people about all the shit I saw, all the fucked up things, how I felt. And at the end of the day, I felt better. Unfortunately, after the election, I saw many problems that I did not agree with. A lot of problems with Obama's policies, things like Guantanamo Bay, which I thought were promised to be closed, the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, the new wars with drones all over, Yemen, Somalia, wherever, and now we see like our civil liberties being eroded. It was 2000 and, gosh, I think it was 2011 when all of those anti-war activists in Minneapolis and Chicago got arrested, and they were served. They were supposed to go before a grand jury, and I found out about this, and I thought, well, what? This is messed up. And that's when I decided to actually participate and get involved. I joined IVAW, and I started going to some events. I started meeting guys. I didn't feel alone anymore, and one of the best parts about IVAW is they really like to focus on veterans' need to heal. We talk together, we talk amongst each other. There's speaking events, there's reading, reading and writing. I really picked up after joining IVAW was starting to write. And since then, I've been published twice. I was published in the Warrior Writer's book for some of the poetry or short writing that I've done. And I also published a book with the Veterans Book Project. And Monica Holler, she is the curator of that exhibit. She's since moved on to bigger and better things. But I can't say enough about what she did with that book project. She just got everybody to write their books and spill their guts. If you haven't checked it out yet, I would strongly recommend it. I started getting involved with combat paper, where we cut up our uniforms and we've made paper out of it. And all that paper, I've got all this paper in my suitcase now. It just sits there. But I cut up. Actually, I carried this flag with me on a combat mission, an American flag. And when I met Drew, who runs combat paper, I told him, I said, I want to make a flag, or I want to make paper out of this flag. And he thought it was the coolest thing ever. And so I cut up the whole flag, and I shredded up a uniform, and we made paper with it. And it's beautiful paper. I mean, it's cream colored. It's got red, white, and blue little fronds flowing through it. It's amazing. I would definitely want to write on it, but I haven't figured out what to write on it yet. So, other things that I've been doing, I volunteer. I'm on the steering committee with our local Peace Action chapter. I started volunteering with Big Brother, Big Sister. I have a little brother that I help out. He's 14 years old, and you know, sometimes he tells me he wants to join the military, and I have to take a step back. I don't want to get angry, but at the same time, I have to tell him about all the things that, you know, because nobody ever told me what it's really like, what joining the military, what actually happens. And so I try to talk to him about those type of things and make it clear to him, like, you're going to have to see some messed up things, you know, like playing video games is not the same. It's just not. So I also work to help other fellow vets, you know, just through meeting people at speaking events and through IBAW and just friends of mine in general who reach out to me and they see things that I post on Facebook or they see things that I write and they say, Zach, hey, how can I get involved? Can you help me? Can you talk? Can somebody, you know, help me file for a disability or how does that work? Or what, you know, and I talk to them because that's what they need. They need to be talked to. You know, veterans, they need people like myself who want to talk to them. You know, I know my buddy, one friend of mine, doesn't want to talk to anybody unless they're a vet because he thinks that they don't know anything. So I guess I look at a lot of these volunteer experiences that I do as some way to repay what I consider to be my own personal moral debt. I feel like I owe the world something in repayment for the wrongs that I've done. And I'm trying to do that as best I can, but it's hard even to say, you know, maybe in the future I'll be able to see something better, but we'll see. And the one last thing I want to throw in is the, probably one of the biggest healing events that I've done was last May. I went down to the NATO summit in Chicago, and I waited in line, and I sat around, and I was nervous, and I felt like a celebrity because all these journalists wanted to talk to us, and I got a lot of anxiety. And then I was told that I had to stand on the stage in front of all these thousands of people and actually say something. And I thought, well, shit, I haven't even thought about what I'm going to say. So I'm standing in line rehearsing and thinking about how I'm going to say something about, you know, the little girls that I saw when I was in Iraq or about the old man or about the women or whatever. And I got up and I said something about I went to Iraq to liberate the people, but instead I liberated their oil fields. And, you know, I've lost a lot of friends. A lot of my old military buddies I've lost, but I've gained a lot of friends in the military, in the ex-military community. Like, you know, I've met a lot of Vietnam vets. I've met a lot of Iraq and Afghanistan vets. And also I've met a lot of people through groups like Peace Action, and now groups like hopefully Progressive Democrats of America. But yeah, it's just been a great ride and I don't expect it to end. And yeah, that's pretty much all I have right now. That's my story. If anybody has any questions, I guess. I don't know, I guess I went a little bit over 20 minutes. I hope that's okay.
Oh, great job, Zach.
This is Virginia. Can I say something? I want to thank Zach for being on the call. very moving. I've traveled all over the country working for peace, and I was just recently in Dallas where we went to protest the opening of the Bush Library down there. And one of the evenings I did attend a session of Iraq Veterans Against the War where they were telling their stories, and it's very moving, and it's very necessary that people hear these things. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name is, excuse me, my name is Lois Hamilton. Zach, you're wonderful. My father, I come from a military family too. My father was a colonel in the Air Force and was commanded a bombing squadron out of Thailand that dropped the bombs over North Vietnam. And he went over there such a hawk and came back. He almost died because he started having heart problems. He thought it really changed him, even though he wasn't on the ground battling. He was commanding, and he'd send home these tapes where he'd be weeping and saying, "I lost two of my boys today." And he always called them my boys. It was just unbelievable. So anyway, I'm old now, and I'm just so glad to see we've got Veterans for Peace. Have you looked into that group at all?
Yeah, we don't have an active chapter of IVAW here in Milwaukee. There's a couple other members, but they, you know, they participate in other things, and so I actually end up going to more Veterans for Peace meetings than IVAW. So.
Yeah, Veterans for Peace are big here in Santa Barbara. We've got Arlington West down on our beach, next to the harbor. It's just amazing.
Okay.
They set up those crosses for all the dead.
Yep. I have some friends that have been down there.
Yeah. So anyway, thank you for doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
Yeah, actually, the Veterans for Peace National Conference is going to be in Madison in August. I think it's August 7th to the 11th. Mike Fox, who does all the phone banking for PDA, is going to be having a panel discussion there.
Great.
Yes, hello, Zach.
Hi.
Hello. I'm Rita Agu calling from Colorado Springs, and I just say kudos to you, Plus. You are terrific for what you are doing. And I have been so impressed over the last number of years of Veterans for Peace. And as one retired Rear Admiral friend of mine said, you're going to have to go a long way before you find people more dedicated to justice and peace than those of us who have seen firsthand the horrors of war. And from what you just said, I certainly got even more of a feeling about what those horrors are about. My heart goes out to you, dear, and I do have a suggestion maybe for what you all could do. Have you ever heard of a poor woman called Kimberly Rivera?
No.
She is the only woman to ever be deported from Canada. She and her family were deported. She enlisted because she had no other option. She was about to lose her job. She had two children, and they weren't eating. They didn't have, you know, any money to spare at all. So she enlisted. And then when she was sent overseas, she was sent in as a guard in the war and told what she had ordered, what, you know, she had to do, which was shoot anyone that got anywhere near the facility she was guarding. And suddenly it dawned on her, she could not in any way shoot and kill civilians and children. She went to a minister, a chaplain, and told him, but he never advised her of her right to go and apply for conscientious objector status.
Yep.
And when she came back to the States, on leave, and she was about to be redeployed. She and her husband and two children went up to Canada, and they lived there for a number of years. She had two more children there. But suddenly the Canadians decided they would deport her. And unfortunately, they did, after their Minister of Immigration advised all the Canadians, including members of Parliament, that nothing bad would happen to her once she was deported to the States. Well, guess what? She was deported, and the minute she crossed the border, she was arrested. You can pull her up online, Kimberly Rivera.
I'll definitely
People
check
from
it out.
All over the world have been signing petitions, and Amnesty International, all the groups go on. And maybe Veterans for Peace might be one of those that have signed petitions. She went through trial here in Colorado Springs, and I got called for some help. I went down and spoke with her, and thank God I did. The girl is now pregnant with her fifth child. She was 8 to 10 weeks pregnant. She was stuck in jail. She ended up with a 10-month sentence. It was originally 14, and then they, moved it down to 10. But she was being kept in a cell that he had lights on 24/7. She was being given rotten food. She could hardly talk when I first talked to her. That's how the jail visits go here. You do it by camera. And she was so upset, and I was so worried about her that I put on my old journalist hat, and I ended up, I got her to relax and laugh a little bit. I tried to help her out a bit, and I told her I'd go out and I'd be raising some Irish hell for her. Don't worry about it. And we laughed. But I did, and thank God, we did a good press conference, and we got press coverage. They went out and interviewed at the jail, and thankfully they did take her out of the cell with 24/7 lights, and they've moved her out to California to a military prison out there, Miramar. I think it's in San Diego area. But my God, she's going to have that baby while incarcerated, and during the trial, the prosecutor even said, "We are going to make an example of you." Well, I think maybe it's time that all of our vets, just like you, Zach, who realize this woman certainly was credible. And she had certain rights that were just hoisted, gotten rid of. And maybe it would be a real good thing if we could get people all over the country continuing to say, we want her to get out of prison early. We want this sentence to be cut. This is not right.
We have a coffee shop down in outside of Fort Hood, Texas, in Killeen.
Uh-huh.
And centered around advocating for veterans' rights, and basically it's like an open house. Any veteran can come in there, and they're allowed to come in, and what the people working in there do, and they're all veterans, they're all volunteers, is they explain to them their rights about, if they want to become a conscientious objector, if they want to refuse deployment, if they want to find out, they can get, because sometimes the doctors try and deploy them against their doctor's orders, with issues like PTSD or some people have even worse mental disorders like bipolar or whatever. And
I well know.
Yep, they just give
Believe
them a bunch
me,
of medicine.
I well know. I have had a psychiatrist with the VA has called me a few years back begging for help. And you know what he told me, quite frankly? This is not practicing medicine. He said our hands are so tied on what we can do and cannot do. And I've experienced that with my own brother. He's 100% disabled vet from the Vietnam era.
Yeah, I'm in the process of applying for disability right now, and I was told straight up that it would probably take about 9 months.
Honey, that's if you're lucky. And then if you get 10, 20, I think 40% is the highest I've heard of late. And my brother with 100% disability has been turned down by the VA 6 different times. They cannot or will not do necessary surgeries on him, and he's one of the lucky ones, honey. Our family, you know, left him with a trust fund, and he has, you know, he's one of the lucky ones. But my heart goes out to all of the vets. 1 out of 3 people here that live on the street in Colorado Springs is a vet, and many of them disabled.
Zach?
Hi.
This is Lori Norby, and I'm in California, and I have found this a very powerful message that you have, and I am so sad to know, I feel terribly sad for you, but to think of how many other people are destroyed, and destroyed because your instincts are, you can't put them behind you, your humane instincts, and it's such a terrible price that you have to pay. I just am so very struck by this, and I will look for every opportunity I have to support the vets here in California, and I wish you well. How tragic that somebody with your moral compass has to apply for disability. That's a shame.
Rob, can I ask a question to Sally Weiss?
Sure, Sally. Go ahead.
Zach, you mentioned someone's name, Monica Hollard, and a book project. Could you give us just a little bit more guidance how we can be sure to find that information?
The website, the name is veteransbookproject.org.
Thanks. That seems pretty straightforward.
How do you spell her last name?
Haller.
Thank you.
Yeah, on our Facebook page, I'm going to post a link to where you can read Zach's book. So if you're all on the End Wars and Occupations PDA Facebook page, I'll have that there. And Jeannie can probably get the national team to share it on their page so everybody can find that link. So anyway, Zach, I really appreciate you coming on tonight. I've known you for a little while, and I've known bits and pieces of your story, but it's the first time I've gotten to hear you, you know, tell it from beginning to end. And you know, when we post that link to Zach's book, it's a pretty in-depth look at some of the stuff that he talked about tonight. So I'd suggest everybody grabbing the PDF version of that so they can read it. Sally, did you want to talk about the Jobs Not Wars campaign now?
I certainly would. I think I've had the privilege of talking about Jobs Not Wars for maybe at least 6 months. Jobs Not Wars started officially in late October or November, right after the election. And we thought it's a part of United for Peace and Justice, UFPJ, and we were part of something called the Afghanistan Working Group that met every 2 weeks. And we decided we were looking ahead to see that the economy was, you know, in terrible shape and really hurting people, and that there were going to be these sequester cuts. And we thought, wow, the peace movement needs to bring to people's attention that a lot of the reason why there have to be cuts is not just this austerity mentality, but because so much of our federal budget goes to military spending. So that's we started out with one other title, but we finally came a little while later, by December, I think, to call ourselves Jobs Not Wars. So I'll just give you the how to reach that. So it's www.jobs-not-wars.org. Somebody else already had Jobs Not Wars, and so we had to put a hyphen or a dash in between the Jobs Not Wars. And so there's a very good website. And what we do is we still have a call every 2 weeks, and we try to get people thinking in their own communities as to what cuts are happening in their town or their region, and then where is there a military facility that in a way is gobbling up our tax dollars. And we take it a step further than that, because we're not really trying to put defense workers out of a job. We want there to be jobs, and we just want there to be sustainable and non-military jobs. So that means we have, on our calls, we have had people talking about economic conversion, which really is the direction that the country needs to go in, and certainly that the peace movement needs to be leading toward, and especially toward a green economy. So that in a way it brings the peace movement and the environmental movement together, and certainly the people who are struggling so hard that our safety net should not be hurt at all, that all sorts of human needs should not be hurt. Like for instance, in my hometown here of Northampton, Massachusetts, we had to have an override of our taxes in order that a bunch of teachers would not be fired before September, that some police and some firemen the same, and a whole bunch of big and little things were going to happen in our wonderful little community here if the voters didn't pass an override. Now, that sort of thing, my husband, who's on this call tonight, wrote a letter to the editor. I made a talk at a public hearing that was about the override. And so across the country, we're hoping that there's people every place. And, I hope there's people on this call tonight that maybe even have heard me talk about Jobs Not Wars before. And that I think the peace movement has a duty to go a little bit farther than our regular vigils. I mean, I'm part of a vigil every week here in my city. So I like vigils. I like noisy demonstrations. I like all the stuff we do. But I think we have to get a little smart and help our society see that its priorities are very out of whack, and we're the folks that can help the society see it. So I'll just repeat, it's www.jobs-not-wars.org, and it's easy there. There's a petition to sign, and it's easy to get to be part of the campaign if it makes sense to you. Thanks, Rob.
Excellent. Thank you, Sally. That brings us to almost 9 o'clock. Mark, Virginia, did you have anything you wanted to add tonight?
No. It's a great call, but no, I don't want to do that.
The only other thing I would add is to watch your emails for the next letter drop. There will be a letter drop coming from PDA, and what I always do is when I'm preparing the letter for my area is I add a paragraph about specifically about war and about what's happening right at the moment and how we need to change our priorities in spending. We certainly do not believe in this austerity. That this the Job Not War program is directly a result of trying to counter the idea that we have to cut Social Security and other benefits, social needs. We're saying we don't need to if we cut war instead. So please make that point to your congresspeople. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, everybody, for joining us tonight.
Hello.
Yes?
Hello.
Oh, hi. I'm having trouble getting unmuted, but I would like to bring a certain case to everyone's attention because there is a conscientious objector who is battling right now against deployment, and the military is no longer honoring the long-standing tradition of allowing for conscientious objectors. I have the manual. I mean, it's an old one, but he was told to report with his gear for deployment, and apparently, there are online petitions being circulated. His name is Christopher Munoz, and you can find his own site, which has one of the petitions that they're constantly updating. They just released something on the 4th of July, but you can go to Christopher Munoz, it's all one name together, .me, and that will take you to a private PV2 Christopher Munoz's site and his battle to not go to war. And apparently he's still not winning that battle, which I think is really startling.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's I think, a good action item for everyone to do tonight. We can include that in a follow-up email, I believe, as well.
Right, thanks.
So, yeah, once again, on behalf of the team, I'd like to thank everyone for joining the call. And thanks to Zach for telling such a powerful story and sharing a little bit of yourself with us. So I think our next call is August 13th. We'll send details out about that as soon as we get our agenda and schedule squared away, and look forward to seeing you all on the phone again soon.
Thanks, Zach.
Thanks, Rob.